this on now so it's recorded. And turn this on. If you could move it as and when.
Our next meeting is going to be the last one of Sunday, isn't it?
Yes.
I'm going to speak from here. I'll stand.
Do you want to speak from here?
Yeah, I'm not. Yeah, stand up.
Jack, are you happy to speak from here?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
That's all.
Never has any notes.
Yep, I'm happy to. I'll try to take turns.
Right, I think we'll make a start. Thank you all very much for coming. It's lovely to see such a big turnout. Last year we had the same lineup in the room next door, which is much smaller, and we had a bit of difficulty fitting everybody in, but this year, luckily, we got a lot of space. This is always a very popular summer event. I think it's rather like the three tenors.
Thank you very much. You haven't heard us sing, have you?
We have the three stars, one from each party, and they tell us what the view of the coalition's foreign policy. I'll come to that in a moment. Just to announce that next Tuesday, on the 3rd of July, which will be our last summer meeting, we have a meeting with Professor Malcolm Chalmers, who's the research director at RUSI, Liam Fox, who's a former Defence Secretary, and Peter Jenkins, who is former United Kingdom Ambassador to the IAEA. And they're going to debate the question, Iran, how real is the threat? Which is obviously, again, a very topical subject, and I hope as many of you will come along. If you'd like to, please let Jacqueline know before you leave this afternoon. But today's debate, and I'm going to spend as little time as I can on introductions, because I don't think I need really to say very much. We have two former foreign secretaries in Jack Straw and Malcolm Rifkin, and we have the foreign affairs spokesman of the Liberal Democrat Party, who's also on the Intelligence and Security Committee and the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, Ming Campbell. So we have a really big lineup to speak on the question of is the coalition government's foreign policy still clear, focused and effective? And if you think that's a bit cheeky, that is taken from a quotation from the Foreign Secretary William Hague, which I thought provided a nice challenge for us today. So I'm going to now ask them to speak in order. They're going to speak for about 10 minutes each, starting with Malcolm Rifkin, then Ming Campbell, then Jack Straw. Jack has told me he has to be away absolutely sharp before 2 o'clock. I will keep the meeting going until 2 o'clock, but then at 2 o'clock, as usual, I will draw it very firmly to a close. But anyway, I'm not going to waste any more time. I'm going to ask Malcolm Rifkin to address us.
Michael, thank you very, very much indeed, and it's a great pleasure to be here today. It's also particularly marvellous that we have so many ambassadors, high commissioners and other diplomats here. I was once told that diplomats were people who could be disarming, especially when their countries were not. And I'm sure that does not apply to any of the countries represented here today. What I want to do in the opening 10 minutes is not to give a general review. There isn't the time for that. I'm going to concentrate on 4 points, and I'm going to be broadly welcoming the government's foreign policy. I think it has been very impressive in many respects, but I do have some causes for concern, which I want to share with you. First of all, an unreserved welcome to the way in which William Hague has almost reinvented the Foreign Office. He's given it a new sense of purpose, and I've been particularly impressed that despite the extraordinary financial constraints, he's announced over the last year the opening or reopening of no less than 11 embassies or high commissions in various regions of the world. And that is to be welcomed not only in itself, but it goes back to what must never be forgotten, the central core purpose of the Foreign Office, which is a diplomatic purpose, and one which cannot be properly advanced unless you have global representation. And the only other point I make on this issue is that each time over the years that an embassy or a high commission has been closed, it's not only been a source of deep disappointment in the particular country concerned, it has actually almost invariably had major regional implications. If you close somewhere in the Pacific or the Caribbean or in South America, the whole region or the whole continent says the United Kingdom's losing interest, it's not involved in the same degree it should be, and therefore there is a knock-on effect entirely negative. The reverse should now be applying, and that is very much to be welcomed. I move to the second point, partly a welcome, partly a concern. And that is the government's reaction to what is the extraordinary ongoing developments in the Middle East, the Arab Spring, so-called. And I unreservedly applaud the initiative that David Cameron took, William Hague took in Libya, along with the French, along with others. I believe, had a very satisfactory outcome. A lot of uncertainty, obviously, still, but that is to be expected. And when you are dealing with a range of countries in the Middle East, very few of whom, if any, have had any real experience of meaningful democracy, of meaningful accountability, of meaningful rule of law, of course it will be two, three steps forward, one step back. Never forget that in Egypt, for the first time since the pharaohs, we had a presidential election, which with all the disappointments involved, nevertheless was an election where neither the Egyptians nor ourselves, or anybody else in the world, knew who was going to be the next president until the result was announced. And that wasn't just because of fear that the election might have been in some way doctored. It was because Egyptian public opinion is clearly very deeply divided. But that is not just a worry, it's also a healthy expression in a democracy of different points of view. And I've no doubt that Egypt, going forward as well as back occasionally, will be experiencing opportunities that are unrivaled in its history. I said I had concerns, not so much about Egypt at this moment, it's about our government's policy and Europe's policy in regard to Syria. And Syria is such a crucial case, and all the rhetoric that is coming through on Syria is excellent and is first class. But is it matching the events of the time? And I think the crucial point is that it's not that there's a risk of civil war in Syria. There already is a civil war in any meaningful sense. Thousands of people are being killed, have been killed. The Free Syrian Army, the opposition forces, are now fighting in the streets of Damascus. They're not going to take Damascus in any short period of time. But the nature of the struggle is extending to the whole of the country and not just one or two localities. The way things are going, it could be months, possibly even several years, before the Assad regime goes. But it is inconceivable that the Assad regime can continue as the long-term government of Syria. So the question is, how can the carnage be brought to an end sooner rather than later? And we have a very curious situation. In the case of Libya, in the case of other problems around the world, we've had United Nations arms embargoes. In the case of Syria, there is only one arms embargo. It's a European Union one. Russia has been involved in helping Syria with its military requirements. It denies that it's providing new weapons, but there's obviously controversy about that. But at the very least, there are arms supplies to the Syrian government, whether it's repairs of their existing weapons or new ones, people will speculate. But that is clearly an important factor. And Syria is undoubtedly getting arms, the Syrian government, from Iran and possibly from other sources. We've heard that the United States is actively advising Saudi Arabia and Qatar on weapons and military equipment in order to ensure it gets to the right Syrians who are fighting the Assad regime. The European arms embargo sounds okay in theory. It is applying to everyone, as it were. But of course, we are in danger of making the same mistake in this respect that was made during the Bosnian conflict. And I was Defence Secretary at the time, and I remember this, and I believe it was a mistake at the time, that an embargo which was on the face of it fair and equal to both government and opponents, in practice massively helped the regime in power, in the case of Bosnia, the Milosevic supporting forces, the Bosnian Serbs, in the case of Syria, the Assad regime. Now, I'm not suggesting that embargo should be removed completely. I think it needs to be modified. And nor should it be leading to military assistance to the Syrian insurgents immediately. The problem, of course, in the Syrian opposition is they're not united. But what greater incentive could there be towards persuading them as to the necessity to unite if one of the consequences of a united Syrian opposition could be much more military support to the Syrian opposition? And I say military support, I'm not necessarily saying unreserved military supplies to the insurgents. But there are ways in which you can help people protect themselves. There are ways in which you can help civilians defend themselves. And we know that such has been the barbarity of the Syrian government, that it is absolutely crucial that there is a better ability for people, men, women and children, to have the means to defend themselves from further attacks of this kind. And I do hope that the Russian government will give some further thought as to whether, quite apart from the morals and ethics of the situation, whether long-term Russian interests are best served by this regime being assisted and by the lack of support in the Security Council for tougher measures against the Syrian government. Because unless one believes that Assad can remain indefinitely, when he goes, any government that replaces him will unlikely be very sympathetic to those who kept him in power any longer, or were perceived to have kept him in power, any longer than was absolutely necessary. Let me move to the third of my 4 points on Europe. It's very difficult to encapsulate all these in just a couple of minutes. But on Europe, I just want to make one, but I think it's a very important point. We've long had these extraordinary discussions about European Union and what the British role should be and so forth. And some of us, not just me, but others, have been arguing for some time that you actually have to have a flexible Europe, allowing those who want to integrate further to do so, but also recognising the equal right of those who cannot go for that level of integration to be enabled to be part of the European Union, but with less integration. We now have an ironical and paradoxical situation that the Eurozone countries are seeking or are being forced to seek fiscal union, financial union, greater degree of political union, and the British government, far from opposing it, is encouraging them to do so. Quite logically, in my view, quite logically, because you cannot have a single currency. It cannot survive, as we've all recognised, or at least most of us have recognised for years, unless you have some degree of fiscal union and political union to ensure that it works effectively. Where I'm slightly critical of the British position is there does not yet seem to be enough either rhetoric or policy as to what not the short term, but the longer term implications of this are going to be. Because it seems to me unavoidable that we will need to have a new architecture for the European Union for the longer term. Let us assume whether it takes 6 months or a year or 2 or 3 or 4 years. At some stage, the Eurozone countries, not necessarily all of the present ones, maybe without Greece or without one or two others, I don't know, but the Eurozone countries are going to have a much tighter degree of European Union, with fiscal union, with banking union, with all the things needed because of the currency situation. And the remaining member states, not just Britain, but possibly up to half the European Union, because 11 are not even in the Eurozone, or 10 or 11, and some others will leave the Eurozone, like most likely in the next 2 or 3 years. So about half the European Union will not be part of that, either because it doesn't want to be or because it's not able to be for the foreseeable future. So we have to have a structure, and I commend what David Owen has been saying on this, as well as others, but I think the British government has to actually itself have not just a national debate about in or out, that's facetious and it's superficial, it's about what kind of European Union is going to emerge from this and what will be our role in it. When all that has been thought through, both in Britain and elsewhere in Europe, of course there will have to be a new treaty. That's when we have a referendum. And indeed, legally, we have to have one in Britain if there is a new treaty, but it will be right to do so. A referendum now is absurd because there's no questions to ask at the moment that would be at all meaningfully dealt with by a referendum. The final point I want to make, and I make it very briefly, but it's a rather important point, and it's also a note of caution to the government. I commend the fact that the Prime Minister and William Hague and others have said that the United Kingdom's foreign policy, its international role, is not going to shrink under this government, that we have to maintain the strong international contribution that we make, which helps the world as a whole, as well as helps advance British interests. That is good. I welcome it. Of course, it is right. But, you know, you can't go on saying that indefinitely if you are simultaneously reducing, not the diplomatic presence, that, as I've said, is going in the right direction, but the defence and military capability. I don't think we're there yet, but there comes a moment when increasingly that could be a very serious problem, working in the opposite direction to the political and diplomatic objectives. I've used before, some of you have heard me use it, the remarks that Frederick the Great once said, that diplomacy without arms is like music without instruments. And it continues to be valid, not because you're necessarily going to use your arms, but because it has to be part of the spectrum of capabilities that you have if you're going to make an important and meaningful contribution towards global security. And the final point I make is this. Some years ago, one of my predecessors, Douglas Hurd, used the remark about punching above our weight. And it was a good description, it continues to be a good description, as to what the United Kingdom often does. If we're not careful, if our defence capability is reduced too far, then there'll be a new question we will have to ask. Not just are we able to punch above our weight, are we thinking above our weight? Now, we're not there yet. Britain remains the 6th, 7th largest economy in the world, which is extraordinary for a country of 60 million. We are one of the major military powers. Very few countries can deploy their military forces around the world. We are one of half a dozen that can and can do it very effectively. And in all sorts of other ways, we continue to have a significant role as a medium-sized power. but we have to not look just tactically at these questions, but strategically. So in commending the government for what it's already achieved, and most of which I overwhelmingly endorse, there are these points of caution and concern which would be wrong not to express. Thank you.
Sir Min Campbell.
When in February 1974 I was the Liberal candidate in a seat called Greenock in Port Glasgow in the industrial west of Scotland, we still had the tradition of meetings in schools every evening. And on one occasion, my wife and my agent and myself went off to the school in Port Glasgow. And it was a typical west of Scotland evening. The rain was horizontal. And the janitor turned up. And after about 30 minutes, no one else, my agent said, look. And he went into the hall outside and he took two chairs and brought them in and put them down in the classroom where the meeting was supposed to be. And he said, let's go to dinner. The daily newspaper in Greenock, and the following morning, the headline in the newspaper was, extra chairs have to be brought into Liberal meeting. The purpose of my story is to say that often perception is more significant than reality. And Malcolm and I had no effort at cooperation or coordination before we came. But it just so happens that the three issues he's been talking about, I want to talk about in a slightly different key. And of course, on this occasion, we're really invited to be analysts rather than advocates. And that's not always easy for politicians. But I just want to say in relation to Libya, I've got three topics. One is Libya, the other is relationship between foreign policy and defence policy, and the third is Europe. And my answer is, if asked about, and I'll say the first is yes, the second is no, and the third is maybe, for reasons you will clearly understand. Libya was a success. It was a success for the United Kingdom and for France. It was conducted with United Nations authority, but we should be very careful indeed in assuming that it provided a template for all such subsequent operations. And that's why the cry, the rather untutored cry, about military intervention in Syria, not nuanced in the way Malcolm suggested, but the untutored cry about military intervention in Syria has got to be rejected. The circumstances in Libya were quite extraordinary. Total air supremacy, monopoly at sea, and no troops on the ground for whom we had responsibility. I can't think of any other intervention where that was the case in recent time. And I certainly do not believe that any intervention in Syria could be regarded as fulfilling these quite extraordinary but enormously benign conditions. So be careful what lessons you draw. It's often said that the lessons you draw from victory are much more significant than the lessons you draw from defeat. The other point is a political point. We had United Nations authority. But the fact is that we pushed the envelope of that authority right out to the margin. And I think there is an argument that we went through the envelope, we went beyond it. And of course that's certainly a view which is very strongly held in Moscow and in Beijing. And it also emphasizes another point which I think is significant, is that the unintended consequences of an action like Libya are often unable to be predicted and can have a material impact on other events which follow subsequently. And just one last point, which to some extent bears on my second point and Malcolm's, and that is this. You don't have to go very far in Washington to hear Americans say, well, it was a great effort by the Brits and the French, but actually, without American logistical support and without American intelligence, it simply wouldn't have been possible. And that once again raises that very difficult question, which once again you hear very often in Washington, is how far and to what extent are the Europeans going to take responsibility for their own defence? And that's not a question which has been, in my view, substantially addressed so far by this government, but it's certainly one which requires to be addressed as we see the understandable determination of the United States to look westwards rather than eastwards. I've talked about defence and security. I'm going to talk about the relationship between foreign policy and defence. Clausewitz, war as diplomacy by another means. If you reduce your armed forces, you reduce capability. If you reduce capability, you reduce your options. Now, the popular question to ask at the moment about defence is, could we defend the Falklands? Well, the answer is yes, we could. But I ask this question in a different form. Could we have defended the Falklands at the time that we were fully extended in Iraq and Afghanistan? And I think that's a question which would almost certainly produce a much more difficult answer. And that, I think, is an important issue which so far, so I said no, so far the government, in spite of the new structure, the new security structure, which the Prime Minister himself chairs, or in his absence the Deputy Prime Minister, has not yet fully addressed. Namely, if we go from 98,000 soldiers, boots on the ground, down to 82,000, what impact will that have on the options available to the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary if a crisis of some kind arises in which involvement by the United Kingdom would be in our national interest? And the third topic, the one to which I said don't know, is the issue of Europe. And I suppose to some extent I'm colloquially paraphrasing what Malcolm Rifkin had to say. Because at the moment, then, the nature of the present relationship between the United Kingdom and Europe is most certainly the subject of public and indeed political questioning. It's also inevitable, it seems to me, that if the Eurozone is to survive, albeit in the truncated form that Malcolm suggested, then that can only happen, and it seems now generally accepted, and even cautiously by Germany, by a much higher degree of integration than at the moment the British public or indeed the British Parliament would be willing to accept. But if that integration proceeds in the direction in which it appears it will, then it most necessarily will affect our own interests. And it's how we respond to that, and in particular, how we assist that integration in order to ensure that we get the stability which is vital to our economy, but also to make the point that we are good Europeans and not Europeans who are forever looking for a way out. There's been reference to a referendum. We've had this discussion in Scotland. What question would you have? If you had a question at the moment, as Malcolm says, would it be in or out? Or do you like it or do you not like it? In the event that there is a fresh treaty, then the coalition agreement provides that there should be a referendum. But I just want to make this point. Supposing the result in the referendum is as narrow as the presidential election in Egypt, what then? In either direction. That could place us in a very, very difficult position altogether. And let me finish by saying this too. I'm fundamentally committed to the notion that Britain's best hope of prosperity lies within the single European market and the opportunities for trade and commerce which that gives. And I'm very, very sceptical about the idea that the Elysian fields lie outside that single market in which we can turn ourselves into Norway or Switzerland and be as successful as either of these two countries. I don't think the parallels are in any sense exact. Now, in Scotland, we argue that they should tell us what they mean by independence, the Scottish National Party, and what the consequences would be. I think those of us who continue to believe in the economic advantage of our presence in Europe are entitled to ask those who want us to come out to say exactly what the consequences would be and what the impact would be on our interests.
Call on Jack Straw.
Thanks very much, Michael. I was reflecting, Ming, that in Blackburn we still have school meetings, but and indeed for reasons which I find inexplicable, especially when I'm taking them, we still have very good attendances. There we are.
Purely coincidence.
Coincidence. Last year, when the three tenors, luckily silent three tenors as far as our singing ability is concerned, gave this end-of-year assessment, I gave the government almost as good marks as my two colleagues. And I will do the same, but with I think, and it's inevitable that with the passage of time, there will be a little marking down. I mean, first of all, on, and you would expect me to say this, on the reinvention of the Foreign Office, there's inevitable tendency, and by God, didn't half we go in for this in 1997, as Malcolm will recall, to fall into the Pol Pot trap of pretending that there was a year zero and everything before that was absolutely terrible. It wasn't quite like that. It wasn't absolutely terrible. There were good things and bad things about our stewardship, not least of the Foreign Office. What was the case was that we had, although we got money off the reserve, there was this huge additional burden of both Iraq and Afghanistan, which inevitably meant that we had to take people, and they couldn't be just recruited outside. Onto those functions. It was also the case that in the then Chancellor, we had someone who needed to be better educated about the value of foreign policy and the Foreign Office. And he partly came to the Treasury with that in mind, but he partly got infected the moment he went through the door, because the Foreign Office has always had this view of themselves as the players and the Foreign Office next door as the gentlemen. As I used to say, the only, if they wanted to go in for a toff count, there were as many toffs in the Treasury, at least as in the Foreign Office. It's just that the toffs in the Treasury used to wear suede shoes. But it was quite, I was pretty happy with the budget settlements I got, but it was hard going. And there was also kind of two legs bad, four legs good view that money spent on the Foreign Service wasn't so good, money spent on DFID was. Now, and I've said this publicly in the Commons, happy to say it here, I'm delighted that that's gone, and because partly of William Hague's position in the political firmament inside the government, the fact that he's very good friends with the with Andrew Mitchell, International Development Secretary, and he has very clear authority with the Chancellor and the Prime Minister, that period has gone. There are still some worries, and I see the Treasury are still up to their normal tricks of proposing that, or believing that there's hundreds of millions of pounds to be released if only parts of the Foreign Office estate abroad was sold off. And they look at, with salivate at the fact that the embassy compound we have in Tokyo is the best address apart from the Imperial Palace in Tokyo, and would be worth billions. There's acres and acres in Addis Ababa. What they forget, conveniently, is two things. One is that almost all of these great estates are tied on covenant, so you have to hand them back. The second is that at the Treasury's track record of forcing the sales of properties has been absolutely appalling. As any here knows, remembers the story about the Dublin or some San Francisco, New York, and others, and they need to be pushed back. But I'm very pleased, and I'm happy to commend William, the fact that he is seeking to expand the Foreign Service, not to contract it, and to open posts, because contrary to the hair shirts in the Treasury, there is no question that if we have representation on the ground, it's not only about expertise, it's also about the message we send out about the importance of those countries to us. And I particularly commend him for the fact that we greatly expanded our representation in India and China. I'm concerned, of course, to pick up a point which both Malcolm and Ming made about the fact that whilst there is a gradual improvement in our investment in the Foreign Service, there's been this significant diminution continuing. in our defence capability. And I agree with Ming and Malcolm on that. I won't labour at the point they've made it, but it was, I mean, I think everyone now realises that, for example, the decision to remove the Harrier force, which is crazy, capricious, ill thought through, and damaging, and there are other aspects of it, and I simply don't believe that it was necessary to cut into the defence forces at the pace that we have, or as far as we have. On specifics, first of all, in terms of the strategy that's been developed, Willem-Hague has talked about deepening bilateral relations, and I agree with that, of course. You can't argue with improving bilateral relations, but there's been kind of implication that that could be done, there was an either-or between deepening bilateral relations and not bothering quite so much about multilateral relations. I don't accept that. I think if I have a criticism of the government, and I do, I think they've not paid sufficient attention to multilateral relations, where so much can be done, and that will lead me on in a second to the issue of the European Union. On the Middle East, yes, Libya was a success and a great tribute to the Prime Minister, to Willem-Hague, and to our Defence Forces and Defence Secretary for what happened there. May I, full stop, and it's, I think, very good for the country that we were able to participate in that way, notwithstanding the caveat that Ming entered about the fact, yes, we did require an awful lot of assistance from the United States to be able to do anything. Syria, I just say to Malcolm, I mean, I am genuinely undecided on this issue about whether it would be appropriate to lift the arms embargo. I see all the arguments for that, but it's a decision I don't want to, I'm not making the decision, it's a judgment I don't want to come to in the absence of the kind of granular intelligence and analysis which is available to a foreign secretary and, frankly, not available to me. And what I worry about is that some of the, we are the only, there's only this EU embargo, but some of the constraints that may be holding back other natural allies of the Assad government may be lifted if we get involved in a what amounts to a proxy war there. So that's, I think, my anxiety so far as that is concerned. There's one area of traditional conflict not been mentioned so far, which is the Middle East. I mean, the Middle East in the sense of Israel-Palestine. And it's off the front pages. In fact, it's off some of the inside pages as well, because there's plenty else to occupy it. Now, that, frankly, suits Israel above all, because it gives them an opportunity to carry on what they've been doing against international law, and without any international authority, which is to continue to steal other people's land and to build settlements right into the West Bank and to constrain the Palestinian people in a way which is wholly unacceptable and unnecessary. And I don't really get a sense of this government engaging much on that. And I think this leads me on to the issue of Iran. The belligerent noises from Netanyahu have gone slightly off the boil recently, and I always view these belligerent noises with some degree of cynicism, because every 6 months, you can almost time it, the Israelis say that they have intelligence which suggests that Iran is within 18 months of gaining a nuclear weapon, then the 18 months comes up and they repeat this, what I regard as a saw. I was engaged, very heavily engaged, in trying to, well, getting Iran to the negotiating table and trying to get them to come fully into compliance with the non-proliferation treaty, which is, by the way, they're not fully in compliance with that, but that's a different issue from whether or not they've got nuclear weapons. And there is sometimes an illusion, a dangerous illusion, of these two. But there isn't any evidence that Iran is anywhere near gaining a nuclear weapons capability. Read what the IAEA says. And even if it were, I'm afraid I take the view of the rather wiser souls in Israel, including the outgoing head of Mossad and the outgoing head of Shin Bet, both of whom have said in terms that, I think the outgoing head of Mossad said that in terms that launching an attack on Iran would be crazy, which indeed it would be. But what Cathy Ashton is leading the talks on the European side with Russia and China and the United States with Iran. Iranians are notoriously difficult to deal with in terms of negotiation. You ever ask anybody, go and ask anybody in the area what it's like trying to negotiate with them for buying a sack full of pistachios or to sell them a bit of marble. They'll tell you that they are notoriously difficult in negotiations like that. It's their character. But it's just how they are. They never stop negotiating. They never stop arguing. And they'll intersperse their argument with bits of poetry, and then they'll come back to the argument. It's deeply frustrating, but we've got to carry it on because whether people like it or not, this is a very important state in the region. And one way or another, crab-like, we've got to develop better relations. We've also got to understand, this is not the moment for this, that major errors by the West, particularly by the Bush administration, more than 11 years ago, actually worked to the West's disadvantage in terms of feeding the hardliners in Iran and weakening the reformers. But we've got to, rebuild relations with Iran. I said when William Hague announced that we were going to close the embassy in Tehran, I wasn't going to second guess him on whether that was the correct decision or not. It's not. I accept that he would have made that decision reluctantly, and his first duty, as Malcolm's was, mine was for the safety of our staff and our assets there. However, what I hope is that the Foreign Office does have a strategy for quickly re-establishing full diplomatic relations with Iran as soon as it is safe to do so. The last area I want to deal briefly with is Europe. It is, in my view, inevitable that there will be a deeper core Europe, by which I mean that those members of the Euro which stay in the Euro, which I think is going to be at least 16, it may be 17, it may not, but anyway, the key countries, are having to face that inevitable logic that you can't have a single currency effectively beyond a single country. It's one reason why a number of us always thought the euro within that architecture was a doomed project, but there we are. They're into it, we're stuck with it, and they can't stay where they are. So they either become it becomes a deeper, much more integrated monetary and fiscal union with fiscal transfer available, or it starts to fall apart. And Schadenfreude is not a foreign policy or an economic policy. It's no point saying, well, we told you so. That would be a catastrophe for us as much as it would for anybody else. Well, that's going to happen. And it is, as George Osborne, Malcolm's referred to this, has said, that's basically in our interest, given that we're starting from here to here. We haven't chosen to start from here. This is where we are. It has consequences for us which we've got to manage, and it's on this that I've got, frankly, the greatest reservations about where the government's got to in terms of its foreign policy. I'm not suggesting for a second we should join the euro. I mean, there is no prospect of that. I think it would be wrong for us, all the rest of it. But I am concerned about the rhetoric which the Prime Minister particularly, and to some extent the Foreign Secretary, has used about other European members. I think that it doesn't help anybody to have somebody who's outside the euro lecture or appear to hector those who are inside the eurozone about what they ought to do. I think that it was an error by Mr. Cameron not to try and build relations with François Hollande in advance of the election, because these things matter. Outside the United Kingdom, outside this room, they come as a surprise to folk here, but politicians have big egos. We of course are renowned for having that psychological treatment to deal with that. But these things really do matter. And although Palmerston famously said it was interests above all which determine countries' relationships, how individuals get on, what sort of personal favours they do each other, as I've seen, makes a very big difference. And I don't think that this approach to other countries' difficulties has therefore been sensible. What I also don't feel is there is a strategy for what amount, it's not so much a two-speed Europe, but a dual Europe. Because, I mean, our, you know, our, the speed of our economy, for example, and what's the metric to which the speed relates? Because it's not in terms of the economy, because the speed at which our economy can go is very much tied in to the speed of the Eurozone, and to a degree, vice versa. I mean, so, but it will be a sort of dual Europe with this core which is making collective decisions for itself. That's the difference. And then there's a looser grouping around the outside which will be having to work on a traditional sort of much more multilateral basis. Now, we need to be working with those partners, which includes self-evidently Sweden, also includes Norway, with Denmark, with the countries in Eastern Europe, which are not members of the Euro, with Turkey, and indeed with some of the CIS, former Soviet Union countries, that difficult though they are, to work in alliance with them, because we all actually have quite similar interests, in not allowing the core of Europe to set regulations which then affect the way our own freedom of action in other areas. And my last point is that I think we need to use this much better as an opportunity for saying to the countries even in the Eurozone, look, yes, of course you've got to integrate better when it comes to the economy, but you need to allow for much greater diversity when it comes to everything else, including social activities. Things like the social chapter, for all that what we said 15 years ago, have not worked to produce the famous level playing field. They haven't at all. Things like the working time directive has hit this country because we observe the rules and because of the state structure of the NHS in a way it hasn't hit other health services. And there is increasing anger about this kind of interference from Brussels elsewhere in Europe as well as here. Proper strategy, we could, I think, find many friends to say to Europe, yes, meaning by all means, this is a single market, and that's from which we draw the greatest benefit. But you don't need to have to go with a single market all the other bells and whistles which have adorned this so-called European project up to now. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jack. Now, to make the most, we've got just over 15 minutes left. To make the most of it, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take questions or comments in sets of three, and then I'm going to ask the panel to comment on those bits of those three that they want to, and hopefully they'll get through a bit more that way. I'm going to ask each of you when I call you to introduce yourselves, first of all, and stand up. Thank you.
So, Kishra Fulton from the House of Lords. My question is specifically addressed to Jack Straw, only because he actually raised the issue of Palestine-Israel. And it's very straightforward. If you accept that the US is the country that has the greatest leverage in the Middle East, and leave that aside, in terms of the UK's foreign policy in the Middle East, Mr. Straw, would you not agree, you probably wouldn't agree, but let me pose the question to you, that this coalition government's continuation with the Middle East Quartet representative has not been helpful, and that the 5 years on, that if we were to play a positive role in terms of peace in the Middle East, we may withdraw our representative and allow the international community to come to a more consensual figure?
Man at the back, yes.
On the internet, the University of Exeter, a question to all three of you about the utility of military power and interventions for stabilisation of failed and failing states. At the moment, the white core elite, every academic pundit you're likely to meet will tell you that we're never going to do that kind of intervention again, that we've moved beyond it. Is that a prescient strategic judgment, or is that a reflection of a post-Iraq cyclops?
And then a man at the back, yes, on this side. Thank you.
Sort of following on from that, can I ask the panel for their assessment of British policy towards Afghanistan and Pakistan in the last 2 years?
I'm going to ask Jack to start because the first question was directly to him and the others were rather more general.
Yes, well, what I've been asked a few people who weren't quite clear, was whether Tony Blair should be removed as the rep from the quartet in the area. Oh, well, unsurprisingly, I don't think so. I think he's doing a good job. It's up to the quartet. I mean, this is not a job for life. The quartet is Russia, the United Nations, the EU, as well as the United States. I mean, I've sat on the quartet, so the United States can't dictate those terms. I assume the others think he's doing a good job, as the United States, if they do. I don't think... you can't ever say never in foreign and defence policy. We don't know whether there'll be another kind of Iraq-style intervention. Depends on the circumstances. Very few were saying there'd be a Libya situation. Certainly I wasn't one of them until it arose. So just had to be prepared for many possible eventualities as you can. British policy, Afghanistan, Pakistan, a very large canvas. I was concerned, it's water under the bridge now, about the fact we made a decision to, announced our decision to withdraw so far ahead as we had. Remains a concern of mine. As for Pakistan, I mean, Pakistan is the most troubling country, more troubling for me than Afghanistan in many ways, for all sorts of reasons. I think we're doing our best with that benighted country, but it is very, very hard going.
Thank you. Malcolm?
If I may just make one comment on the Tony Blair question, I can't help but go back to Leo Amery's famous remarks, you have stayed here for far too long for any good that you may be doing. Remember the second half of that quote. If I may move to the second question about military intervention, I think generally speaking, military intervention is a mistake unless it has United Nations Security Council endorsement and unless you have actually been invited by either the country concerned or at the very least the regional players to intervene in order to help global security. I think you've got to always bear in mind each country, each crisis is different and requires different solutions. And as Ming rightly said, the methods that were used in Libya just cannot apply in Syria for the reasons that he quite correctly referred to. But, you know, I think the mistake we often make in many of these matters is we look for a good solution as opposed to a bad solution, a good policy as opposed to a bad policy. Nothing wrong with that, but it's very rare that there is an unreservedly good solution or good policy. Sometimes in the murky world of international diplomatic relations, you have to decide what's bad and what's less bad. And the remarks I made earlier about the need, as I see it, to give more active help to the Syrian opposition is not meant to be a good suggestion. It's meant to be to address a less bad way than simply standing back and allowing the status quo to continue with all the carnage that is involved. On the final point about Afghanistan and Pakistan, I just make one comment in the time available. Given that our original purpose in going into Afghanistan was to prevent Al-Qaeda being able to use that country as a base for international terrorist operations, then to withdraw from Afghanistan now is to withdraw having achieved that, not having failed to achieve that. The failure, if it is a failure, is because foolishly we adopted other objectives and made them part of our public presentation, ending corruption, building democracy, women's rights, all of which are marvellous objectives, but could never, even with the best of winds, have been achieved in the time available, and clearly are not going to be achieved in the way that was hoped. But Al-Qaeda is a shadow of itself in Afghanistan, and increasingly next door in Pakistan as well. The future threat from Al-Qaeda, and it is still a threat, is primarily in Yemen, in Somalia, in parts of northern Africa, perhaps elsewhere. But the original purpose for Afghanistan has largely been realized, and we should never lose sight of that fact.
Ming?
Yeah. Very quickly on the Middle East. United Kingdom is always going to be subordinate to the United States. This is presidential election year. What is the American government's policy towards the Middle East? Well, do as little as you possibly can, because it's presidential year. And we can only hope that if Obama is re-elected, then he will take up the Middle East as a second-term issue. Rather, as George W. Bush did, but he did it too late in the cycle. So we must hope for something rather better than that. Military intervention, remember that intervention was as first described by Tony Blair in the Chicago speech in 1999 with a set of criteria which have since been developed, particularly in Canada, to what is called the duty to protect. And one of the considerations when you take account of regional support, whether you've got legal authority from the United Nations, whether it's a severe attack on human rights, the last criterion must be, are we likely to be successful? Will it be better after we do it than it is at the moment? And I think these criteria will be much more rigorously applied, perhaps, than they have in the past. And remember, Sierra Leone and Kosovo were two great successes, two great triumphs, in my view, for Tony Blair. You don't often hear me say that. On Afghanistan, we can review our policy, but the fact is the policy is now set. Withdrawal in 2014. I'm firmly of the view that the British public would not have accepted anything else. It's quite right that the purpose was to try and prevent Al-Qaeda from using a base upon which they could cause terrorist activity here in the United Kingdom. And I think that purpose has been served, but one has to point to the Yemen and indeed what Jonathan Evans, the director of MI5, said yesterday, I think in a speech or an article, the fact of the Arab Spring, which you have all hailed, has actually given an opportunity to potential terrorists, to achieve a base and to use that base. And I don't think it's any secret that the Olympic Games, which are, 43 or 42 days away, will be an enormous test of our resilience in security in such circumstances. Finally, Leo Emery was drawing on Oliver Cromwell, whose remarks were addressed to the Rump Parliament and finished with the sentence, "In the name of God, go."
And very, very sadly, Jack's got to leave
us. In the name of God, go.
nothing personal.
He's got to go and chair a meeting. I'm very grateful to him for coming. Can you say thank you? Michael, the gentleman at the front here first.
I would like to introduce myself. Yes. Salas Kiani from Pakistan High Commission. And Chair, it's a very good meeting, and we appreciate the comprehensive discussion about Middle East, Europe, and also Britain. And about Afghanistan and Pakistan. And Pakistan is the allies of Great Britain and America against the terrorism. And Pakistan has given 40,000 innocent lives. And we are still suffering. But my question for the panel, that it discuss about Libya, Egypt, and Syria, but there is also burning issue in subcontinent, that is Kashmir, in between India and Pakistan. Because both countries are have atomic capability and need to be resolved that problem according to the resolution of United Nations 48 and 49. And I need that it should be discussed also here. Thank you.
Thank you. Gentleman at the front, on the left.
Hello, Ben Jones, Interrail Consulting. Just drawing on the points you made about defence capabilities, it's been estimated by RUSI that at the peak of its acquisition costs, the Trident renewal programme will take up about 30% of the defence equipment and support budget in the 2020s. What sort of upper ceiling would you put in terms of the percentage that we should be spending for the defence budget on Trident before it becomes untenable?
And a gentleman right at the back.
Stuart Powell. The coalition agreement had an explicit statement in support of developing the Commonwealth, and that hasn't so far been touched on by the panel. The mood music from the government so far has been good, and Sir Malcolm was a member of the Eminent Persons Group proposing reform. Something is on the current study of the foreign affairs committee into the Commonwealth. But what does the panel believe should be the expectations of the British government, both in terms of the current reform process and in terms of greater vigilance on human rights? And also, what do they believe the British government should do to give greater practical expression to its support for the Commonwealth?
Thank you very much. I'm afraid, given the time, that's probably the last group of questions we'd be able to have, but I'm going to ask Ming if he'll stop.
Yeah.
Come with those.
Well, if there was a solution to Kashmir, someone would have found it some time ago. It is an enormously difficult area. The position which the British, successive British governments have held to has been, I think, if I'm right, the reliance on the Simla agreement, which is to the effect that this is an issue between two countries and not an issue upon which it would be appropriate for the United Kingdom to become engaged. And I do remember Robin Cook, who was Jack Straw's predecessor at the Foreign Office, in opposition as the Shadow Foreign Secretary, raised the issue in a particular context, and I won't say in which context he raised it, but all hell broke loose on the other side. And then when he was Foreign Secretary, and he went to the continent, he raised the issue and all hell broke loose on the other side. So it really is a topic which requires the judgment of Solomon. And in the end, my strong, strong view is that only the two countries can resolve it. It's not to say there aren't huge risks. What was it? 1 million men under arms across the line of control about 5 or 6 years ago. Two countries with a nuclear capability. Pakistan with a nuclear capability designed to try and offset the enormous conventional superiority which India has, which would almost certainly echoes flexible response in the Cold War in Europe. It would almost certainly mean that Pakistan would be the first, or might feel compelled to be the first, to use nuclear weapons. These are very, very difficult issues. I'm afraid I don't have any obvious solution. On Trident, I don't think you could do it on percentages. Ben Jones, slightly concealing the fact that he and I wrote a paper on Trident for Nick Clegg some considerable time, along with Nick Harvey, some considerable time ago. I believe in the utility of the nuclear deterrent. I've never departed from that. It wasn't always the most popular thing in my party. But I believe you've got to explore circumstances in which you may maintain a sufficient deterrent at a lower level. And that's what's happening in the Ministry of Defence at the moment, in an investigation and review being carried out by Nick Harvey, Lib Dem, who's the Minister for the Armed Forces. But Trident is a lot of money, and the great Michael Quinlan, who was the architect of the Trident programme when he was Permanent Secretary in the Ministry of Defence, wrote in a very interesting book shortly before he died, that there comes a point at which you have to balance the utility against the cost. And that will always necessarily be a value judgment. Finally, it's quite right you should ask about the Commonwealth, because I spent quite a lot of time this morning cross-examining Sir Malcolm about the Commonwealth, because the Foreign Affairs Committee is conducting this investigation, and as a member of the Eminent Persons Group, he came to address us, and as ever, eloquent and to the point, and that's why I'm going to concede this question to him.
Malcolm.
Thank you very much. First of all, on Kashmir, the problem has existed for very many years, right back to the late 1940s. It will continue until both India and Pakistan judge that the time is right for each of them to make the necessary concessions, to show the necessary flexibility to achieve an outcome. I don't think I can be contradicted in saying that when on any international problem, when people are trying to find solutions, they find solutions. When they're trying to find problems, they find problems. And although there have been times when one or other country has been genuinely anxious to resolve this matter, we've had little opportunity for them both to wish to do so with the degree of flexibility that was required. One of the problems which has helped prevent that was, until fairly recently, the broader relationship between the two countries was awful. And I remember for many, many years, Pakistan, sir, declined to actually even develop its trading and economic links with India because it believed that the overall political relationship did not permit that. In recent years, we've had a lot of progress in that sphere. Both trade, political links between the political leadership in India and Pakistan have made very real steps in the right direction, if not on Kashmir, at least on the bilateral relationship. And if that can be built upon further, and the atmosphere of massive distrust right across the whole relationship, which has made it a very, very dangerous situation, was one of the most dangerous in the world, if that could be removed on the wider bilateral questions, then the atmosphere that might permit political progress on Kashmir will be achieved. The rest of the world might influence us at the margins. I have to say, sir, the answer to Kashmir lies in Pakistan and in India, in New Delhi and in Islamabad. Either there will be a solution or there won't, depending on that relationship. Let me mention the Commonwealth before I come to Trident. Yes, I gave evidence to the Select Committee this morning. The particular question that was asked just now was the British government's position on that. I have to say I've been hugely impressed by the government, because compared to previous Labour and Conservative governments, it has been hugely more positive on the Commonwealth. David Hull's appointment as Minister of State was specifically as Commonwealth Minister. That's been his overriding commitment. We have seen a number of High Commission posts opened or not closed or reopened by William Hague. And although we had a serious rebuff in the Eminent Persons Group when the Commonwealth heads of government declined to endorse our recommendations for a Commissioner for the Rule of Law and for a Charter for the Commonwealth, the British government and a number of other governments from both the old and new Commonwealth were strongly in support. Unfortunately, the Commonwealth only acts by consensus, so even a small number of countries that are hostile can prevent resolutions being endorsed. But the British government couldn't have been more supportive throughout that period. So it's not just rhetoric. The substance of policy has been pretty good. Finally, on the question of Trident, I'm a member of the Global Zero movement, which believes in working towards not just a reduction in nuclear weapons, but if possible, a complete elimination of them. That's where I'm coming from. But a fundamental point about that, and it's a point that I had to clarify when I became part of that movement, is that it must be by multilateral disarmament. That the arguments of the 60s and 70s about unilateral disarmament, which were unconvincing then, remain supremely unconvincing now. There's two issues. There is the question of multilateral disarmament as a principle, and it is the question of whether you can actually ever reach zero, which we don't need to actually address until we're a long way towards it than we are now. Britain itself has come already a long way. Britain got rid of tactical nuclear weapons, got rid of free-fall nuclear bombs, substantially reduced its the weapons, the warheads that are used for both Polaris and for Trident, and made a whole range of other decisions, which means that we're pretty close to a minimum now. And the specific answer to your question, sir, and here I very much agree with Ming, is you can't address this in terms of percentages. You chose to mention the percentage of 30% of the procurement budget, which is true for some years. I could say that overall, the percentage that our nuclear deterrent represents of the defence budget, which is a more relevant one, is closer to 4 or 5% over the years. And therefore 95% is on other matters. But whatever we talk about percentages, the argument at the end of the day must be, is this necessary for our ultimate security as a country in a world which is nuclear? That would not be an argument for creating nuclear weapons if you didn't already have them. It is a question for those relatively small number of countries that have them. Can unilateral disarmament ever be a serious or sensible option? And I don't believe it can be or should be. A final point on whether we can have a nuclear deterrent by other means. The only other option that has been seriously canvassed is whether we could have cruise missiles with nuclear warheads. It actually, when you begin to look at it, it is a totally unrealistic option for two reasons which I mentioned very, very briefly. First of all, you have the alarming situation that a submarine which carried both nuclear or conventional warheads, how would a potential enemy know which kind of missile you'd launched? It would be enormously destabilizing when it might not even be a nuclear warhead in the first place. But a more fundamental problem is that the assumption up till now has been if you want to put nuclear warheads on cruise missiles, you go to the United States and ask them to provide the missiles, just as we have done for Trident. The Americans no longer have such missiles. They came out of cruise nuclear warheads in the 1990s. They've had them in storage. Even the storage is being dismantled. We would actually have to start from scratch. And therefore you'd end up with a nuclear deterrent, far less of a deterrent than Trident, for all sorts of reasons I haven't got time to go into, but which wouldn't even save us much money. It might even cost us more, because you'd be into a whole new territory of trying to create a new nuclear weapon that the United Kingdom does not currently have, and we'd probably be in breach of the Non-Proliferation Treaty as well.
Thank you very much indeed. Can I just endorse what Malcolm said about having David Howell in the
Foreign Office, because David, in terms of the Commonwealth, has been the great champion of the Commonwealth for many years and has often made the point that we spend, I think it's 33p per head on the Commonwealth and £6.20 on the European Union. He feels there's a disparity there that somehow should be altered. Can I also say, I think we've had a very, very good session. I probably disagreed with more of what they all said in terms of foreign policy than they did with each other. The three tenors really did sing reasonably well in harmony. I remember when my musical days, the Irish used to describe as a bum note as when you got out of harmony. I don't think we had any bum notes today. I'm very grateful to them all. I'm grateful to Jack Straw, who's left us. I'd ask you to thank them in the conventional way. Thank you all very much. And see you again soon.
Have a very quick.